Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with 26 states meeting in Paris to form a strategy and a military alliance to combat the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, and look into the key regional state that is absent from the anti-IS coalition, Turkey. Sona Çaptay, who writes extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations and Turkish domestic politics and is a regular columnist for Turkey's Hürriyet Daily News, joins us to discuss why Turkey is taking a back seat in the regional response to the Islamic State until the fate of the Turkish diplomats and their families being held hostage by the IS in Iraq is resolved. Then we'll get an economic analysis of the impact of Scottish independence on both the economies of a new state that may emerge from Thursday's vote and on the UK, where both the ruling Tories and the opposition Labour Party are urging a no vote in the referendum. Economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, who is Emeritus Fellow at the Institute for Development Studies at Sussex University and Associate Fellow at the Overseas Development Institute in London, joins us to discuss the contradictions of having independence from Britain while Scotland retains the Queen as head of state and the pound sterling as the currency. Then finally, we will speak with Paul Kyle, who covers business and the economy for ProPublica, about his latest study at ProPublica, co-published with NPR, Unseen Toll, Wages of Millions Seized to Pay Past Debts. We'll discuss how many employees across the U.S. now lose up to a quarter of their paychecks over debts like unpaid credit cards, upon which 26% interest rates compound the debt, often doubling or tripling it, or medical bills and student loans, which most states allow creditors to garnish at the highest rates permitted under federal law, one quarter of the after-tax wages. And joining us now is Sona Çaptay, who is the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He has written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations and Turkish domestic politics, and he is a regular columnist for Hürriyet Daily News, which is the oldest and most influential English-language newspaper in Turkey. He also serves as chair of the Turkey Advanced Area Studies Program at the State Department's Foreign Service Institute. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sona Çaptay.
Thanks. Good to be with you, Ian.
And there is a broad coalition meeting in Paris, 26 countries, including the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Russia, a meeting to combat the Islamic State. Conspicuously absent, though, is Turkey in terms of joining the coalition. What are we to make of that?
Turkey's absence, I think, should be regarded through the lens of the country being an invisible partner to the United States. Ironic as it might sound, this is indeed the Turkish position. Turkey does see ISIS as a huge threat. And in the long term, because of the nature of this group's presence right next to Turkey's, right on Turkey's borders, obviously, let's be clear on one thing. The Turkish threat perception from ISIS almost precisely overlaps with that of the U.S. perception. But in the short term, the Turks are really scared of ISIS. That's because ISIS has about 46 Turkish hostages, including babies in its hands. And I think Turkey is publicly not present at these summits and not signing declarations because it's hoping in the meantime to secure the release of these hostages. And it doesn't want to cross paths with the organization before it does that.
And these were hostages that were taken by the Islamic State in Mosul. These are families of diplomats, right?
That's correct. When the Islamic State attacked the Iraqi city of Mosul, which is Iraq's second largest city, the biggest shock to the Turks was the group also targeted the Turkish diplomatic mission in that city, the Turkish consulate, and took the entire staff and their families hostage. That includes the Turkish consul and security officials, diplomats, and their families. There are two children, and there's also a baby in the hands of the group. And I think the fear in Turkey is that, you know, the group could commit atrocities, those people. And that's why they're really going slow, and they're trying to be as quiet as they can, even though they are obviously part of the U.S.-built coalition against ISIS.
So is there, though, another element here, Sona Çaptay, and that is that this U.S. initiative might elevate Turkey's rival in the neighborhood, Saudi Arabia, at the expense of Turkey and the Muslim Brotherhood?
I think the Turks are basically realizing that their support to the Muslim Brotherhood parties in places such as Egypt and Syria and Libya has unfortunately not delivered Turkey greatness. When the Arab Spring started 3 years ago, the policymakers in Ankara, the Turkish capital, thought that by putting their support behind the Muslim Brotherhood parties, which they thought would come to power as a result of the Arab Spring, they would make Turkey a regional power with proxies through regional capitals from Cairo to Sana'a. That has not happened. In the Arab Spring, the Muslim Brotherhood parties have been sidelined in all countries. They have been ousted from power in Egypt, sidelined in Yemen and Libya, forced to step down in Tunisia, and in Syria, they've been sidelined by hardliners, Al-Qaeda and others on the battlefront. So 3 years later, Turkey has no proxies whatsoever in the region, and it's actually left with quite negative relations with some of these capitals, because the Egyptians, when they look at Turkey, they see Turkey's policy of supporting just the Muslim Brotherhood party in Egypt as rather partisan, and those who don't support the Brotherhood obviously are offended by Turkey. So I think Turkey has a lot of bridges to mend in Arab capitals.
Again, I'm speaking with Sona Çaptay, who's director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He has written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations and Turkish domestic politics, and he's a regular columnist for the Hurriyet Daily News, which is the oldest and most influential English daily newspaper in Turkey. He also serves as chair of the Turkey Advanced Area Studies Program at the State Department's Foreign Service Institute. So, Sona, my understanding, though, is that, well, let me ask you, is there a sense of blowback going on in Turkey in terms of permissive support for these jihadist groups in fighting the Assad regime in next door in Syria? My understanding is, and the former U.S. ambassador to Turkey, Francis Riccardoni, said that Ankara had worked closely with the Islamic State and al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra and other extremist groups in a vain attempt to moderate or control them while trying to overthrow the Assad regime, and that they've invested an awful lot of effort in it, and they don't want to see this whole thing come to nothing. And also, adding insult to injury, is the idea that this coalition the U.S. is developing might increase Saudi influence at Turkey's expense.
Yes, indeed. I think Turkey is suffering from a blowback. I think Turkey's Syria policy has been ill-conceived, and it goes along the following lines. I wouldn't, first of all, say that Turkey supported the radicals, nor would I say that Turkey was or is in bed with the Islamic State. I think it's very simple that Turks don't do jihad. I think this is a democracy, obviously. There is no political violence in any form or shape across the Turkish political spectrum that is seen as legitimate. So I think Turkey is about and beyond the fray of what the Islamic State is trying to accomplish. And it's actually antithetical by the fact that it's a secular democracy to what the Islamic State represents. But the Turks tried to play a tactical game. They thought that they really wanted to oust the Assad regime. They wanted him to go. They wanted to support the rebels. And I think they did the morally right thing in the very beginning of the Syrian uprising by opening their doors to refugees coming from Syria, and also started to allow rebels to use Turkey as a staging ground. Then I think the Turkish policy went into dangerous terrain, because Turkey thought that Assad would go, the Syrian dictator, he would go, that good guys would take over, and that if it was, you know, a few bad guys went into Syria, that was fine, because when the good guys took over, they would clean up those bad guys. 3 years later, we see that this is entirely ill-conceived, because number one, Assad is not going, he's staying around, his supporters will continue to hold on to large parts of Syria. Number two, good guys are not taking over. Number three, it's the bad guys who are sweeping up the good guys and not the other way around. So this has left Turkey with a problem. The radicals who have crossed into Syria have not only started to take out the liberal and the moderate elements of the opposition, but they're also threatening Turkey. And I think that's the blowback Turkey never expected it would have to face, because the whole scenario was that all these good guys are going to Syria would eventually be swept up and cleaned up by the reformists and the moderates who would take over from Assad. And I think in the absence of that, the Turks are waking up to the reality. And the wake-up call was when the Islamic State groups took the Iraqi city of Mosul and also attacked the Turkish consul in that city. The Turks are waking up to the reality that there is this enemy next door, which is not only going to target innocent people in Syria and Iraq, but also going to target Turkish national interests, including Turkey's diplomatic missions. So now Turkey's challenge is, how do you encounter the growing ISIS threat? And I think that suggests a pivot by Turkey to NATO and to the United States, because Turkey has neither the intelligence nor the hardware or the drones to target and fight and contain a group such as ISIS. So after having played on its own for a number of years in the Middle East, trying to be a standalone actor, independent of the United States, Turkey is now pivoting back to the U.S. because it has to.
Well, but this has to be done quietly, right, and under the table. That's what you're saying.
Yes, and
the fact that they're not attending—they're not attending any of these meetings. They did attend the meeting in Jeddah with the foreign ministers, but they didn't sign on the. And they're not
in Paris.
They're
attending all the summits, and they are receiving all the visitors. You know, secretaries Hagel and Kerry, who went to the Middle East, they obviously always are stopping in Turkish capital Ankara. But the Turks are absent in all the summits in the sense that they're not signing anything in the conclusion of these summits because they don't want to confront ISIS publicly in the eyes of the group before they can obviously secure the release of their hostages. So I would say Turkey's presence in the anti-ISIS coalition is going to be one of an invisible partner, a partner that really doesn't want to publicize its participation to the extent that it can.
Well, Sona Chaptai, let's not underestimate how complicated things are in Syria, and particularly for the United States to know exactly whose side the people are on that we're supposedly working with. They're fighting as much amongst themselves as they are against the Assad regime. And even the Free Syrian Army, which is the alleged moderate rebel group, they are basically declining to join in the U.S.-organized anti-ISIS coalition. So that speaks volumes, doesn't it?
I think the Syrian opposition, the moderate elements of it, have been decimated by the Islamic State. I think what we saw was a civil war that was being fought by the Assad regime and moderates has turned into a civil war that's fought between the Assad regime and the radicals. It's because the radicals increasingly, I think, wiped out the moderates. So the challenge for Turkey and for the United States right now is you know, how do you build up the moderates again? You know, do you fly weapons? Do you fly advisors? Do you train them? Or do you do all of these things at the same time? And there's sort of a little appetite in the U.S. to put boots on the ground or to provide, you know, increased support to these moderates. There are detractors who suggest that, you know, providing weapons to the moderates is not a good idea because they'll end up in their own hands. There are others who say that there are no moderates. I think the percentage of moderates in the opposition has gone down significantly. I think the moderates represented a majority of the opposition when the uprising started, but the radicals have really increased their strength. But it's never too late, in my view. I think you have to start at one point to support the moderates, lest the entire opposition turns into a radical movement. And then I think the United States is going to be left with an ugly choice of picking between al-Qaeda radicals or Assad regime's dictatorship.
But there is a group that are fighting the Islamic State, both in Syria and in Iraq, and that's the Kurdish Peshmerga. And Turkey, of course, has had some rather ambivalent relations with the Kurds, particularly with the radical Kurdish groups. They did capture the leader, Öcalan, and they do seem to have very, very deep ties now with this new Kurdish state in the north of Iraq, which is not officially declared, but is a de facto state, and that's where most of the military activity is now being launched from the north of Iraq, the Kurdish area, against the Islamic State. So walk us through how things stand with Turkey and the extent to which, because we know that there are, 20 million Kurds in Turkey, and the Iranians have an equal concern about Kurdish independence because they have about 13 million Kurds inside Iran. So neither Turkey or Iran want the Kurdish north to be openly independent. But Turkey seems to be working with this de facto independent state.
I think the numbers are probably a little bit different. As far as I know, the number of Kurds in Turkey is about 15% of that country's population, maybe a little bit higher. Turkey's population is 75 million. So that's probably about 10, 15 million Kurds. But nevertheless, you have a very interesting point of view, which is that until a few years ago, many people thought that Turks and Kurds hated each other, and Turkey simply did not get along well with the Kurds. That is no more the case. And the reason is because the Arab Spring has created the most unlikely alliances, even bringing Turks and Kurds together because they face a common threat. That's the threat of ISIS. And not only that, but Turkey has also built a really good economic relationship with Iraqi Kurds in the last decade. The Kurds who are autonomous in Iraq, and they're actually pretty much near independence in terms of their political ties to Iraqi government, nevertheless have binds. They still have to sell their oil to the central government, and they've been using Turkey to bypass the control of central government so they can sell their oil and gas to the outside world through Turkey. Turkey has reciprocated to this opening, so now you have this deep energy economic relationship between Turkey and the Kurdish region of Iraq. Of course, the Kurdish region of Iraq now sees this big threat coming from ISIS. The reason why we started looking at ISIS only a few weeks ago is because ISIS started to threaten the Kurdish region of Iraq. Its capital, Erbil, was about to fall, and that's when the United States authorized military action. Turkey has pretty much similar view of that Kurdish region as does the United States. It will not allow it to fall into the hands of ISIS. And I think this also goes for the Kurdish regions in Syria. Turkey will protect those regions as well. So here we have an interesting alignment. Turkey, Iraqi Kurds, and Syrian Kurds are all coming on board because they have one threat that they perceive, that's ISIS coming from the south. And I think for Turkey, the Kurdish regions of Iraq and Syria, which lie in the northern part of those countries and therefore form a buffer zone, a cordon sanitaire between Turkey and ISIS, is indispensable. So Turkey is going to do everything it can to defend these regions and to protect them and to bolster their presence against ISIS.
But my understanding, Sanat Çaptay, is that the U.S. has been leaning on Turkey to crack down on the illegal sale of the oil that comes from these oil fields that the Islamic State has captured, both in Syria and in Iraq. And there is a black market going on there. What's your understanding about whose controls that black market and whether Turkey can turn off the tap? Because obviously there's some doubt about the military utility of bombing ISIS out of existence. That doesn't sound like a viable prospect.
I'm led to believe that this is an illegal pipeline in the sense that it's oil that's captured by ISIS is then shipped into Turkey through pipelines that actually run across the border, under the border rather. So it's similar to the smuggling pipelines you have along the U.S.-Mexico border and other places. And I think Turkey really has a tough job to cut down this activity because perhaps ISIS makes as much as $1 million from this activity, if perhaps a little bit less, perhaps a little bit more, in terms of selling Syrian oil, and it's taking it out to the markets. And in the long term, because ISIS is a threat to Turkey, and because ISIS is a bigger threat to Turkey than it is to the United States, it is up to the Turks to cut down all financial lifelines of this group. That includes its ability to obviously export Syrian oil as well.
So when you say it's $1 million, is it what, $1 million a day, a week, or what?
I think it's $1 million a day. That's the figures I have seen. That's a huge number. Obviously, they have to cut down on this activity as soon as possible.
Right. Well, just in closing then, Sanat Çaptay, what's your sense of when Turkey would, you say it's contingent upon the release of Turkish diplomatic hostages that the Islamic State is holding, but if that deal is made, and you know they're pretty ruthless, I wouldn't count on it. I don't know how you make a deal with these guys, but at what point do you think Turkey would be overtly involved? That big NATO air base at Incirlik, which is quite nearby, would obviously be a part of the mix. At least I'm sure the U.S. would like to use it. What's your sense of when the gloves will come off?
I think if Turkey is able to secure the release of its hostages, what we'd really see its gloves coming off if ISIS threatens the Kurdish zones of Iraq and Syria. If it threatens to overrun them, then you would really see the gloves coming off the Turks' fist, because ISIS overrunning these enclaves would mean that ISIS becoming a neighbor of Turkey, and this is something that the Turks absolutely do not want to see happen. So everything they can to prevent, obviously, that from happening, and that means they'll be defending the Kurdish enclaves together with the United States.
Well, Sanat Çaptay, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Sanat Çaptay, who is the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He has written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations and Turkish domestic politics, and he's a regular columnist for Hürriyet Daily News, which is the oldest and most influential English-language newspaper in Turkey. He also serves as chair of the Turkey Advanced Area Studies Program at the State Department's Foreign Service Institute. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with an economic analysis of the impact of the Scottish independence vote.
الأسود الأسود يا ويلي الثوب الأسود يا
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, who is Emeritus Fellow at the Institute of Development Studies at Sussex University and Associate Fellow at the Overseas Development Institute in London. She is currently the Financial Markets Program Director of the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University and is the co-editor with Joseph Stiglitz of Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephanie Griffiths-Jones.
I'm delighted to be here again. Thank you.
And Stephanie, what do you make of the idea that British celebrities are having a big concert in Trafalgar Square in the middle of London, David Beckham, Susan Boyle, Vivienne Westwood, etc., to express their solidarity with Scotland being in the UK? They're against the Scottish independence. There are, of course, celebrities on the other side, particularly Sean Connery, who are supporting Scottish independence. But I've been told by people I've talked to recently in Scotland that everything that Cameron, the British Prime Minister, has done has sort of been wrong-footed and backfired. And most of the no on independence messages come from London. They don't come from Scotland. And the idea that a bunch of celebrities are in Trafalgar Square in London trying to express their opposition to Scottish independence, again, seems wrong-footed. Why aren't they up there in Scotland making their case?
Well, I think that's a very correct point. I mean, I think all this stuff about celebrities is a little bit superficial. But, of course, because this is a very serious matter. I mean, I think that for the United Kingdom to be breaking up would have quite serious consequences, which need to be considered in a sort of weighty way. Economic consequences and political consequences. On the economic side, I think there are some risks, particularly in the short term, because there is no clarity about, for example, what currency arrangements would be, would exist, what kind of treatment the debt, the oil, other assets would have, what are the arrangements for the nuclear weapons, which the Scots don't want, and the British would have to move. So there's a number of issues that are very open and that would need very serious debating. I think partly the Scottish enthusiasm for independence has to do, as you were hinting at, with the dislike of a Conservative government in the UK. There's a joke going that there are more pandas in Scotland than Conservative members of Parliament. There's only one Conservative member in the Scottish Parliament. And there's a long-term resentment of Conservative government and policies in Scotland. But I think to base on that a decision to go independent is a little bit also superficial. And I think maybe the Scots should consider all the joint history they've had with the UK. Not all of it was good, but in recent decades, it has been very positive. And all the costs of the division.
Well, Paul Krugman had an opinion piece in the New York Times, a column recently urging the Scots not to take this path. Basically, his argument was that you cannot have political independence without economic independence. And he made the case that Canada, next door to the United States, has its own currency, whereas Spain, as a part of the euro, has had a terrible time. because it cannot independently deal with its own economics. And the fact that the Scots are continuing with the pound will have all of those complications. What's your opinion of Krugman's analysis?
Well, I tend to agree very much with Paul Krugman, because these were seen as theoretical considerations. When the euro was created, it was said that you couldn't have monetary union without some fiscal union. But now it's a practical consideration, because we've seen the tremendous cost that countries like Spain and Greece and Portugal have paid, because they had a common currency, so they couldn't devalue. But at the same time, they didn't have the possibility of accessing significant fiscal resources, as, say, when California was in trouble or New York was in trouble, the U.S. federal government could help. So having a separate country and having a common currency without having common fiscal policy, we now know from the experiences of the euro crisis, is can be very bad. And in this case, it will be particularly bad for Scotland itself. And therefore, it's a bit irresponsible to try and keep a common currency, which I think if they were to go independent, which I hope they don't, because I think there's a lot of common heritage and common values and common economic ties, then I think it will be very hard to sustain a single currency and could be very harmful. I'm actually at the moment in the Czech Republic, when the Czech Republic split from Slovakia in the early 1990s, they wanted at least initially to have a common currency. And that lasted just about a month, because there was pressure from the financial markets to divide the currency, since the economies were divided. And then the Slovak crown fell, and eventually an equilibrium was reached. But it would be much better in that case to have a separate currency. But the leader of the nationalists in Scotland wants to keep a common currency, wants to keep the Queen. So it's a bit strange. If you why do you want to be independent and then keep all the ties with the United Kingdom? I think there's a quite contradictory position, which could end up by being harmful to the Scottish economy and the Scottish people.
Again, I'm speaking with economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, who is an emeritus fellow at the Institute of Development Studies at Sussex University and associate fellow at the Overseas Development Institute in London. She's currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University, and is the co-editor with Joseph Stieglitz of Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. So given that disconnect, that Alex Salmond on the one hand is leading the charge for a Scottish independence, but on the other hand wants to stay with the Queen and as a head of state and with the pound as the currency, does seem a bit of a contradiction. But presumably, though, there would be an interregnum, wouldn't there, where they could consider their own currency or even adopt a new currency. I mean, this is not an all-in-one step, is it, this leap into the unknown?
Exactly. I mean, there would be, I think, a period of around 2 years of negotiations on all these issues of debts, how to split up the debts, how to split up the assets, how to define the currency. The problem is that, unfortunately, financial markets, as you know, are extremely short-termist, and they will start exerting pressure. They've already put pressure on the pound, even when the polls seem to indicate that the yes option could win. So it would be, and the pound is, of course, an international currency. It's obviously not as important as the euro or the dollar, but it is still quite important internationally. And so, therefore, there are a lot of people, institutional investors and others, that are invested in pounds, large volumes of trade, and the effects that this could have, I think, are a little bit concerning, and I'm not sure it's been fully thought out. So although in practice, as you say, very little would happen initially, the economies would continue to be very integrated, and there would be a very slow process of division, I feel a little bit this pressure from the financial markets that could destabilize a British economy which is actually just beginning to do quite well and recovering finally from a very painful crisis. And it would be quite unfortunate if that was in any way derailed. Unfortunate for the rest of the UK and unfortunate for Scotland.
Well, as you pointed out earlier, Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, the politics are such that David Cameron, who has tried to invoke his Scottish heritage and it's landed like a bit of a lead balloon, he represents the Tories, the Conservative Party. There's only one Tory member in Scotland. Extremely unpopular, the Tories are in Scotland. The Labour Party has, I think, about 40 seats in Scotland. They're panicked because if Scotland becomes independent, then Labour loses 40 seats and would become a minority party and have a hard time ever getting back into the majority. But in terms of the economics, you've only got 5 million people we're talking about seceding into a new state of Scotland, as opposed to what, 50 plus million in the UK. The fact that they would have all that oil, although it's hard to know exactly how long it's going to last, just on the surface would indicate that are the revenues from the oil distributed throughout the entire UK? And if the Scots got all those revenues, wouldn't that disproportionately favour them?
Well, yes and no, because there's also a system of allocation of public resources, which is called the Barnett Formula, and that is biased towards, that favorable to the Scots. So you have to combine the benefits of having additional oil revenues, which, as you say, will be decreasing, and the loss of this Barnett Formula. So there are different calculations, obviously, depending on whose political side people are. But I'm not sure that the balance would be more favorable to the Scots. I think also, personally, in a sort of globalized economy where you have these super giants like, China, United States competing, Europe should be thinking more about how it acts collectively. Individual countries and within that the whole European Union and leading into these nationalisms which splits countries rather than unites them is I think quite negative. Of course, also it would be negative not just in the UK context, but it would put pressure on the Spanish to maybe give more autonomy or independence as some want to Catalonia, and there could be pressures in Veneto and in Belgium and so on. So these kind of nationalist forces born of discontent with the economy and so on are, I think, overall negative trends. I mean, I have, of course, sympathy for some aspects of the Scottish independence idea in the sense that they want a more equal society. And it is true that the UK has become more unequal as the United States has, and they want to change that model for a more equal society. But it would seem to me better if they were to fight for that within the UK. And if for example, the UK, there's a Labour government in the next after the next election, then there could be a chance both for Scots to have greater autonomy, greater decentralisation, which is has been promised to them, actually, by the three political parties. They have more or less agreed, the Conservatives, Labour, and the Liberal Democrats, that they would give them more autonomy. And also they could fight for a greater equality of income distribution, which is, I think, a good aim, which the Scottish Nationalists have, but which they can share with progressive forces in the rest of the United Kingdom. So I think they can achieve these aims in a form which implies less costs and less risks above all.
So the vote will be on Thursday. So it's obviously getting very tight. And as you mentioned, there was an earlier poll that said that the yes vote might win, and that panicked the financial markets. And it's difficult to know at the end of the day how the Scottish people feel. I talked to a political science at St Andrews recently, who was appalled at the fact that the United States only has one consul general up in Scotland and getting all their information from Westminster, from London, from the US embassy there. And the implication was that maybe the US will be caught by surprise with a yes vote. But the one thing that I understand that is likely to happen here is that there's an even more critical vote in many ways coming up soon after this Scottish independence vote, and that is whether or not the United Kingdom will stay in the European Union. And do you think the contagion that you're talking about and this vote in Scotland could actually influence that vote? And if the British pulled out, the British people wanted to pull out of the EU, that would be really a tectonic shift, wouldn't it?
Well, I think that would be extremely harmful. I mean, that depends very much, of course, on the results of the next general election in the UK, where Scotland would still be part of it. And if Labour wins, Labour, as the Lib Dems are, who might play a small role in if they were supporting the Labour Party, they are both very clearly in favour of Europe, and they would only do a referendum if there was a major treaty change, which there hasn't been and is unlikely to be. So there would be no referendum. If the Conservative Party won, they have promised, Cameron has promised, caving in to the right of his party and to the fear of UKIP, this pro-exit. UKIP is a party that wants the UK to exit. They have promised a referendum on whether the UK should leave the European Union. And that would be very tricky because the political parties have not been very clear about the great benefits for the UK of being within the European Union. Plus, of course, the European Union has been going through a bad patch. But I think in the long term, there's, at least from an economic and political standpoint, I think there's no doubt that it is a positive thing for the UK to be in the European Union, where it sells, for example, half of its exports. From which a lot of its foreign direct investment comes. So in economic terms, it's very clear that it's advantageous for them to stay within the European Union. And as I said before, you're competing with countries like India, China, Brazil, United States, massive economies. And then to become so small, a fractured, even worse, if you can think of a fractured UK, and not being part of the EU, this would be very, very bad. And again, great costs of transition, great uncertainty. So it's like these self-goals. The UK is trying to impose on itself this kind of narrow nationalism rather than having a vision of how to overcome the crisis, go beyond the crisis, concentrate on investing in new machinery and infrastructure, and above all in people, investing more in education, improving health. You know, these are the important things that I think ordinary people want, and the politicians have got a little bit mixed up, have lost a little bit the sense of direction in the UK, and I think this is really very, very unfortunate.
Well, already Cameron's getting a lot of criticism for basically, in many ways, he's getting blamed for the possibility that this vote could go to yes and Scotland could become independent because his efforts have backfired. And presumably, if the yes vote wins on Thursday, this will really damage Cameron ahead of the election. So the possibility of them taking this reckless vote to get out of the EU under pressure from the right wing of the Conservative Party, that may not happen. So,
you may be right, yeah.
Right. Well, that's a good reason. But sorry, go ahead.
Yes, I mean, also because the way he set up the referendum in Scotland, he didn't give an option of what they call Dev Max, which is he could have offered them. What they are now being offered, the Scots, is a greater devolution, greater powers within the United Kingdom. There was a possibility of having three options, and he did not do it. He put it as a sort of in-out referendum. Mm-hmm. So that made the choice very stark. And if the Scots were to vote yes to independence, then I think he would have quite a lot of responsibility for that. And there are rumors that he might be even forced to resign, which I'm not sure. But in any case, that wouldn't necessarily be a good thing because you could get even more Eurosceptic leader because the Conservative Party is really full of very deeply Eurosceptic people, which I think is extremely negative. There's a misunderstanding of all the gains that Europe has made. I mean, starting with peace since the Second World War, but also tremendous economic prosperity, not in the recent crisis, but over the post-war period for about 40, 50 years. So all this is sort of forgotten in this very narrow debate about the EU. And so it could diminish in the short term the potential. If the Scots decided to go independent, it could diminish the chances of the Tories getting back in, as you say. But in the medium term, it could increase their chances because Labour would lose all the Scottish MPs.
Well, Stephanie Griffith-Jones, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been very interesting, as always.
Again, I've been speaking with economist Stephanie Griffith-Jones, who's Emeritus Fellow at the Institute of Development Studies at Sussex University and Associate Fellow at the Overseas Development Institute in London. She's currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University and is the co-editor with Joseph Stiglitz of Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about how millions of Americans have their wages seized, garnishing up to a quarter of their paychecks for past debts.
Built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Kyle, who covers business and the economy for ProPublica, reporting on the foreclosure crisis, consumer debt, and other financial issues. His latest study at ProPublica, co-published with NPR, is Unseen Toll, Wages of Millions Seized to Pay Past Debts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Kyle.
Thank you.
And this is a disturbing study, and it's not entirely clear how many people across the United States are affected by this ability for creditors to garnish people's wages up to one quarter of their after-tax wages. And it's particularly, I thought, rather powerful story of this fellow Kevin Evans, who started out with a $7,000 credit card debt to Capital One, and then because of interest payments, it ballooned to over $15,000, and years later, he's still paying it off. He's only paid off about $6,000 of it. So what happened there? I thought for the longest time that consumer debt, student debt were immune from this kind of garnishing, that mostly people had their wages garnished because they owed child support.
Well, that has been traditional view, and that was the reality. I mean, consumer debt was never immune from garnishment, but in reality, most garnishment was for child support and things like that. And this has been a big shift in the last 10 years or so, particularly with the recession. There was a huge explosion of lawsuits, a lot of it around credit card debt. But I think another important point to make is that there's a lot of these suits that stem from medical debt, from high-cost loans like payday loans. So it's more than just the recession. It's something that's a kind of part of the life of people who make income kind of in the lower end of the middle income scale. So the highest rates of garnishment were for people who made between $25,000 and $40,000 a year.
But it seems that quite often these people don't recognize the consequences because in the case of the fellow that you profiled, he didn't go to the court, right? He perhaps it came in the mail, but the picture of these courthouses across the country filled with creditors, but no debtors are there, and you've got attorneys for hospitals, debt buyers, and lenders milling around the podium, and basically just automatically getting these default judgments because the debtors failed to show.
Yeah, that is the most common outcome, is people simply don't show up for a variety of reasons. I mean, I think one big point that hopefully comes out of this is that this is not a rare, you know, recourse that a creditor or a collector will take. This is very common to take people to court, but courts are made for lawyers, is kind of the simplest way to put it. You know, it's not like, you know, there's laws now that try to make it intelligible for you to read your credit card statement. That's not how, you know, courts are built. So, you know, you're sucked into this system routinely, people in this income level, where they get served with a lawsuit and they're supposed to know what to do about that. And, you know, one other aspect of this we're going to do some work to point out is there are some laws that kind of help, that are there to try to prevent people from becoming destitute, basically, from having all of their wages taken. But this is not a system that's, again, made easy for consumers to navigate. So quite understandably, people are confused by what's happening to them. They are bewildered. They don't understand the consequences. And so hopefully a news story like this that points out that this happened to 4 million people in 2013, will, you know, spread some awareness of how common this is and how this is essentially part of our consumer financial system now.
But in the case of the fellow that you profiled, Kevin Evans, he apparently, before the recession, had a nice home, and he was, you know, doing well like so many people in the country used to, and then suddenly he's had a really rough time, finally gotten a job, and then he gets this, you know, sticker shock when he opens up his paycheck at work. It seems like he didn't have any idea that he was being blindsided like this.
Yeah, and I think he's pretty typical. I mean, there was just a wave of layoffs when the recession hit. He'd had a pretty good paying, you know, solidly middle class job, and just was completely clobbered by the recession. Had periods of unemployment, is finally starting to get back on his feet.
Right, he lost his house, didn't he?
Yeah, he had to sell his house. He unfortunately avoided foreclosure, but he was stuck with his credit card debt. And the laws in Missouri and many other states, are not made for people to kind of get out from under this stuff easily. So in Missouri, he had a 26% interest rate running on his Capital One credit card. It never stopped running, even after Capital One went to court and sued him. So now they have a judgment running at 26%, and that's how, you know, what was about a $7,000 debt turned into a $15,000 debt. So even though he's made, you know, well over $6,000 in payments, he still owes about $10,000. So that's, I think, pretty typical of a system that is not really made, you know, with any concern for people to be able to get out from under debts like this in a way that's not creating hardship.
But I understand also that Missouri law allowed Capital One to tack on an extra $1,200 for the bank's attorney's fees?
Right. Yeah, and that's something that ranges widely from state to state. I mean, these are attorneys that are churning out literally thousands of lawsuits a year. I guarantee you that attorney did not spend $1,200 worth of time on the case, unless his, you know, hourly rate is something like $10,000 an hour. So it's just another way that consumers can be gouged in the system.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Kyle, who covers business and the economy for ProPublica, reporting on the foreclosure crisis, consumer debt, and other financial issues. His latest study at ProPublica, co-published with NPR, is Unseen Toll: Wages of Millions Seized to Pay Past Debts. So there are four states in the United States that apparently don't allow employers to garnish their employees' wages stemming from consumer debt. That's Texas, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and South Carolina. So there's no uniformity across the United States. And in the case of Missouri, apparently, you know, some of the states cap the interest payments at least. So yeah. Just walk us through this hodgepodge.
Yeah, well, it's kind of hard to walk you through because it is a real hodgepodge. Things are all over the place. So, you know, in certain states, like you said, an interest rate can run forever. I mean, Missouri is particularly egregious because not only do they not cap the interest rate, but they don't cap interest rates in anything in that state. So I did a story last year about a woman who had a loan running at, I believe it was like 200%, and, you know, it exploded on her from like a $1,000 debt to literally $40,000 she was owing, even after having paid a number of payments, because she simply could not keep up with the interest. So that sort of thing happens in some states and not others. Others will cap the interest rate, you know, something as low as 2 or 4%. Some states strictly limit the attorney fees. Other states don't. And some, like you said, don't allow wage garnishment at all. Others, I mean, California, I believe, allows up to 25%, but some of them try to make provisions to kind of prevent the poorest people from having their wages garnished. But it's really all over the map, and I think one of the big takeaways is that generally very little thought has gone into this system. I'm not sure there's this number of 25% of how much wages can be garnished. Like, it's not apparent to me that any thought at all was given to whether that's something that people can afford. I mean, there are numbers and statistics and surveys out there that show that for people, particularly in the lower end of the income spectrum, that's simply not affordable. And when a wage garnishment is put into place, there's no consideration of whether you can afford it or not. So it's on the debtor to make whatever trade-offs are necessary to get to the next month. So, you know, you're choosing between, you know, gas, electricity, and food and clothing and stuff like that.
So it seems like when you undertook this study, Paul Kyle, for ProPublica and for NPR, there really hasn't been a national study, and it's not easy to do, right? Because you had to basically get a big national payroll service to give you access to their payroll records. And they don't represent, of course, that's a sample across the country, isn't it? So we don't really know how many millions of Americans are affected by this, who are having their wages garnished for consumer debt, student debt, or medical debt.
Right. I mean, there was nothing. There's nothing. There's no data. All this stuff happens in state courts. State courts have a wide range of, you know, systems and how up with the times they are. So even though all this stuff is happening through, you know, public courts, there's just nothing that gives any sense of how widespread it is. So, yeah, we had to, you know, we thought it was a huge gap in terms of knowledge of what's going on there with consumers and, you know, household balance sheets and stuff like that. So that's why we approached ADP, who was really the only people we could think of who might be able to shed some light on this. And it is just a sample, but it's a very healthy sample. They looked at 13 million employees across the country. So it seems like a very good starting point to get a handle on this. And, you know, that's the number that comes out of that is 4 million people in 2013 had a wage garnishment for just consumer debt.
And student debt, I take it, is a whole different kettle of fish, right?
It's a whole different. So that's part of that number of 4 million. Is a whole different kettle of fish in that for government-backed student debt, which is the vast majority of the debt, there's this whole separate process. So there's an administrative process that's kind of handled by your loan servicer or the debt collector. The levels are different, so they can't take up to 25%. They can only take up to 15%. And there is a fair amount of that that's out there. So, you know, the number has been about $1 billion collected that way, going back the last 3 or 4 years. So that's also happening very often. And one thing that can also happen to people is that their tax refunds can get seized by the government. So that's another aspect of the financial system that's pretty common, and I think not many people realize it's happening.
But it's interesting that the state that you profile, in the sense that you profile this one fellow Kevin Evans in Missouri, and Missouri is pretty draconian in its in terms of its laws being sort of bank friendly and not consumer friendly. I've been reading stories lately following the Ferguson, Missouri case of the young African American man who was shot, that the city of Ferguson, in effect, had created a system akin to the old debtor's prison. And this story has sort of echoes of that too, you know, that the city was dependent upon basically speed traps to get its revenues. And, of course, being a majority African American community and largely poor, these people quite often simply couldn't keep paying these tickets, and they'd go to court, and then they'd get judgments against them, and you almost got to a state of a debtor's prison. So is there something about Missouri?
Yeah, it's not just Missouri, and something similar can happen with this sort of thing. So what does happen and has happened in Missouri, and I heard from advocates in Oklahoma where this had happened, is you get sued over a consumer debt. This is not like traffic tickets, which you were saying, which also happens. You get sued over consumer debt, and then there's a judgment against you, and the plaintiff is allowed to call you to court for something that's basically called like an asset hearing or a debtor's hearing, where you're supposed to show up so they can interrogate you about, you know, what is your job, what do you have your bank accounts. You're supposed to be able to put all your stuff on the table so they basically know how to take money from you. If you don't show up to that, then you're not showing up to a court hearing that you were ordered to show up at. Then a warrant for arrest can be put out, and something kind of similar can happen where you can essentially be put in jail because from something that originally stemmed from a consumer debt, and the warrant is put out because you didn't show up at that court hearing. So anytime you get courts involved with stuff, things can get pretty scary for debtors, I think.
Well, Paul Carl, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Kyle, who covers business and the economy for ProPublica, reporting on the foreclosure crisis, consumer debt, and other financial issues. His latest study at ProPublica, co-published with NPR, is Unseen Toll, Wages of Millions Seized to Pay Past Debts. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Land here on the